you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Paul and Philip Collins back on the show. They are the authors of The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, and they're also the authors of the forthcoming Invoking the Beyond. Paul, Philip, how are you doing?
Hey, not bad. How are you, Tim?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having us.
So, you penned, I guess this is part of your forthcoming book. This is excerpted from your book, Contingent Divinity, The Golden Calf of the Universe. Materialism, sort of this tendency for materialist or atheist to worship creation, as opposed why they deny the creator. Contingent Divinity, who wants to lead off on it?
Sure, I'll pick it up. This is Philip, by the way. Well, astute listeners will automatically identify the main title of the article, Contingent Divinity, as this juxtaposition of mutually exclusive terms. Things that exist contingently might not have existed at all if it had not been for some other causative forces external to them. Contingent things do not exist necessarily. They are not self-sufficient. They do not exist independently of other causes. And this condition of contingency pretty much defines the physical universe that we presently inhabit. No matter how it is divided or apportioned off, no ultimate explanatory principle can be found anywhere or with anything in the physical universe. Physical things always find their origins with other physical things. And you will really never discover the origin of material reality by looking to matter itself. Instead, you will find yourself beset by that most perennial of philosophical problems, the infinite regress. In this case, it's an infinite regress of finite physical causes. And that physical regress rapidly diminishes in explanatory power, as one finds reality is teetering upon this never-ending series of other ontologically contingent causes. You know, as the old expression derived from Hindu mythology goes, there are turtles all the way down. And of course, that aphorism refers to, you know, the mythological idea of a world turtle that the cosmos supposedly straddles. According to that myth, this world turtle sits astride the back of an even larger turtle, which constitutes a mere pillar, and an indefinitely continuing column of turtles, hence the aphorism, turtles all the way down.
And the author E. Michael Jones just had a recently had a conversation concerning that that analogy with a Hindu student, where he basically pointed out, well, it can't be turtles all the way down. There has to be an unmoved mover, you know, and there has to be a conductor for the train. You know, there has to be, you know, the it can't be all boxcars and all. There has to be something with the principle of motion inherent in it,
right,
leading the charge. And,
right. Yeah, and again, it diminishes an explanatory power. I mean, it's the same as just saying, you know, well, what came before that? Well, this. Well, what came before that? Well, this. Well, this. Well, this. And all of these causes are finite material causes, and they do not find the reason for themselves in and of themselves. And herein is the fatal flaw of materialism. No single finite material cause can account for the existence of all other material causes. The physical universe simply does not wear the reason for its existence on its sleeve. The irony is that modern scientific materialists have actually co-opted this argument from infinite regress and turned it against theism, in particular, the theism of the traditional Abrahamic faith. They argue that when you invoke God as the creator of physical reality, you have actually explained nothing because you have not identified who or what created God. Now, it should become clear to anyone that this reformulated version of the argument from infinite regress is premised upon a serious category error. It assumes that God is some finite being that somehow inhabits the ontological confines of the physical universe. The question of what preceded God only makes sense if he is part of the spatio-temporal order. And clearly, none of the traditional Abrahamic faiths regard him as such. Instead, the traditional Abrahamic faiths hold that God ontologically transcends the spatio-temporal order. And in the case of Orthodox Christianity, it holds that while he transcends the spatio-temporal order, he nonetheless is also immanent in that he also fills it and pervades it. But because God transcends that order, questions concerning who or what preceded him are just really meaningless. When one speaks of God in the traditional Abrahamic sense, one is speaking of a being that exists in a state of atemporality. Nothing preceded him. Nor did anyone or anything create him. There was no before, and there is no after. He does not inhabit the spatio-temporal order, so talk of what came before him is virtually meaningless. There is no time. Thus, the argument from infinite regress is not applicable to the God posited by the traditional Abrahamic faiths. It's only applicable to physical beings inhabiting an order of finite physical causes.
But the covert forces that we talked about in our first book, which we'll elaborate upon in our second book, they basically planted a mind disease in the scientific establishment that now runs on autopilot, where these poor souls can't, They just can't think outside of anything other than physical causes. They just can't look beyond a physical causative factor for everything.
Well, you can't posit the, you know, finite physical causes as being the originators of all that is. That doesn't answer the ultimate question of why there's anything at all. This is a question for ontology, and ontology really is not even a scientific discipline per se. It's not at least one of the disciplines of the physical sciences. It's a philosophical discipline. It's a subsidiary of the discipline of metaphysics, which deals with what is real.
But it's with this category error that one begins to discern a pantheistic spirituality implied by scientific materialism. Because God ontologically transcends the physical cosmos, he transcends its contingency as well. He exists necessarily. He encapsulates the very reason for his being within himself. His existence does not depend on other external causative forces. However, scientific materialists habitually conflate the divine with the finitude of the physical universe, as is evidenced by their misuse of the argument from infinite regress. They can't think of anything outside of the ontological confines of the physical universe. They can't possibly even conceive of a cause outside that of the physical universe. And that flawed thinking that's running on autopilot is guaranteed that it will continue. When you look at the institutions of higher learning and you see what kind of tests they're taking, there are all these standardized tests that give you about four choices per question, like a multi-choice question format, where you have to select the answer that pleases your teacher, yeah, and the answer that pleases your the answer that satisfies the teacher, that also satisfies the board that drafted these tests and conceived these tests, is the answer that basically posits a materialistic narrative behind creation.
Yeah.
And so the test that they administer makes sure that ensures that this kind of thinking is going to run on autopilot. And whenever you try to get them to move past this and see it as a philosophical question, then you'll have individuals like the host of the new incarnation of Cosmos.
Neil Tyson deGrasse.
Yeah, Neil Tyson deGrasse saying, don't go into philosophy. That'll just mess you up.
Yeah. Well, you find amongst many of them, the late Stephen Hawking, for instance, proclaiming that philosophy is dead. Well, of course, they would love to believe that philosophy is dead because, first of all, it leaves us epistemologically stymied. We can only deal with what is quantifiably and empirically demonstrable. And secondly, because philosophy is very concerned with terminological exactitude and definitional clarity, it allows for them to play fast and loose with the terms they invoke, such as evolution. They invoke these terms with a great deal of interpretive elasticity. And without philosophy there to basically impose this insistence upon terminological exactitude, ultimately these words, this esoteric vernacular that they invoke, can mean whatever happens to be advantageous to them.
But those multi-choice tests, those standardized tests, only offer you so many different answers to choose from, and the answer that is always going to be right is the one that basically posits a material cause for everything. And if you had something more along the lines of an essay test, a test where you not only declare what your position is, but you have to defend that position, the people that are proposing a transcendent author of everything would probably be able to defend their position a lot more effective than the individuals that try to say that it's a matter of physical causes, because they would get stuck in this feedback loop of just infinite regress.
Isn't that kind of a control mechanism, because the operating system of the Anglo-American, empire is right now, or at least the position is Darwinism, materialism, and
absolutely.
If you're in academia, you're simply not going to go too far if you go against the the doctrine of academia.
It's the position of the masters of the Anglosphere for certain. You know, it's basically about the preservation of that of that system that was started by the British Empire and by their Anglophile fellow travelers here in the United States when the mantle got passed to the elites that were found on the Eastern Seaboard, you know, those Atlanticists and all. But the funny thing is that to preserve this Anglo-Saxon dominance, they had to actually abandon Anglo-Saxon forms of learning, classical learning that one finds among the Anglo-Saxons, and go with a Prussian model of learning. So which is kind of the ironic thing, is that you're trying to preserve this kind of Anglo-Saxon form of control by actually abandoning the educational models that were posited by the Anglo-Saxons and go for this Prussian model, which basically seeks to create a system where there are people that receive a very holistic education and are taught really how to critically think, and then you move down to those who are taught administrative level positions but don't receive the critical thinking as part of their instruction, and then below that the great mass of humanity that are taught basically how to do very menial tasks and aren't taught anything remotely approaching autonomous thought.
Well, at any rate, because scientific materialists cannot make the distinction between creation and creator, as is evidenced by their abuse of the argument from infinite regress. They cannot think of a being that does not inhabit the ontological confines of the physical universe. Because they make that conflation, scientific materialists tend to assign virtually deific qualities to the physical universe. And an inescapable theological conclusion of this description is that all life is the product of an entirely immanent divinity. Now, in the ancient world, this sort of divinity was typically hypostatized in the form of a goddess. For instance, the Greek goddess of Aphrodite originated from the material world, specifically the waters of the sea. In fact, the name Aphrodite is etymologically derived from the word aphros, which means sea foam. Such myths really didn't evaporate, though, with the mist of antiquity. For instance, in 1903, A.B. McCallum attempted to establish a causal relationship between the salinity of the sea and the salt content of blood plasma. Now, McCallum contended that this causal relationship, or so he believed, what he saw was a causal relationship, affirmed the evolutionary account of man's emergence from the sea.
That's it, huh?
I mean,
science.
Yeah, there you go. Boom. Science. And now hold my beer.
Science, and then they'll make a painting of creatures evolving, emerging from the sea on some museum somewhere, and that'll be proof.
Yeah, exactly, which is interesting because all that is an artistic interpretation. So you're basically engaging in the arbitrary creation of a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But before its refutation a few years later, this supposed scientific fact was promoted in support of the evolutionary narrative. The author Ian Taylor, in his book In the Minds of Men — that's not Fire in the Minds of Men by James Billington, it's just titled In the Minds of Men by Ian Taylor — he astutely observes that the evolutionary portrait of foam-born humanity vaguely echoes the Greek myth of Aphrodite. Evidently, the shamans of scientism give their tenuous assent to certain myths, albeit through a distorted interpretive lens. And this twisted hermeneutic of scientific materialism is exemplified by the words of none other than Harlow Shapley, an academician, and also, if I'm not mistaken, he was a self-avowed Marxist. He said, quote, in the beginning was the Word, and it has been piously recorded, and I might venture that the Word was hydrogen gas, unquote. So, of course, the gospel according to Shapley. Yeah. Of course, Orthodox Christianity understands the Word as Jesus Christ, through whom all things were made, and that's in the Gospel of St. John, chapter 1, verse 3.
Yeah, the Logos of the universe, yeah.
Exactly, the Logos. Well, now, while Shapley was, without a doubt, speaking rather facetiously, his pun exemplifies scientific materialism's tacit attribution of divinity to matter. In the case of his little cute aphorism, hydrogen was imbued with deific creative powers. By conflating hydrogen with the Logos, Shapley implicitly elevates matter to the status of an infallible, absolute creative principle, and such an immanent divinity is the object of the scientific materialist veneration. Now, in modernity, the scientific materialist either explicitly or implicitly hypostatizes immanent divinity in the form of a living organismic cosmos. Like the Greek myth of Aphrodite, Darwinism presents the primeval oceans of the earth as the crucible of all terrestrial life. And in light of these parallels, the chronocentric contention that modernity has banished the gods of antiquity is really just untenable. Instead, modernity has actually revitalized the gods of antiquity. Now the ancient goddess is invoked by the power elite in the form of a wrathful earth goddess. This angry deity routinely sends hurricanes, floods, droughts, and other natural disasters as punishment for environmental degradation. There are famines because climate change. There are Syrian refugees because climate change. There is itchy foot fungus because climate change. All of this really amounts to just an anthropomorphic attribution, this anthropic attribution of natural disasters to the will of an immanent god, or in this case, the goddess, hypostatized in the form of a goddess. And invariably, the demanded recompense of this goddess is the same: technological apartheid and population control. That is what we must do to appease her. And these edicts are affirmed by scientific materialists who constitute this new priestly caste.
And it's strangely similar to the, some people suspect, as the agenda of the elite to impoverish or depopulate and also create sort of a breakaway civilization, an Elysium, if you will.
Right, exactly. And this is where we return to the theme of our forthcoming book, The Beyond being a force that acts as kind of like a surrogate for divinity that is invoked by the ruling class to basically ontologically and epistemologically dwarf man, to basically overshadow all of his governmental institutions, any forms of representative government, and basically dignify the technocratic paradigm. Mm-hmm. The existence of this priestly caste of scientists and policy professionals, people who have expertise, people who are in possession of the sociopolitical gnosis that is the prerequisite for basically running the world. They have an inside track on the immanent divinity. And if I might throw in right here, earlier we brought up how this is used to basically preserve the system that was established by the British elites and their fellow travelers, the Anglophiles fellow travelers here in the United States. Well, Cecil Rhodes, who really got the ball rolling, was heavily influenced by Freemasonry, if I recall correctly.
He was actually a member of a Freemasonic lodge.
Yeah.
And it was their protein thinking that gave rise to his confession of faith.
Yeah.
Well, Freemasonry has been seen as kind of a conduit for elitist groups, and at different times has acted as an elite combine. Well, it's interesting to see that this group, which is really a driving force behind covert politics in the world, that they posited this grand architect of the universe, and as being the divine author of things. And when you think of an architect is working with existing materials.
He's not
willing those materials into existence. He's working with something that's already there. So, this group that is that's been behind the covert politics that are really driving the world, and it's been an elite conduit for God centuries now. Was one of the groups that is responsible for this belief in divinity being a manet, because the architect, is an immanent player. It's not something that's transcendent.
Right. Yeah, and Freemasonry itself is, at least since the 1720s, was taken over by the Whigs in Great Britain put it in the service of the British Empire.
Right, that's absolutely correct. They acted on behalf of the interest of the Whigs, and interestingly enough, and I'll be coming to this here shortly, Erasmus Darwin, who was a Freemason, and Charles Darwin's grandfather, and the expositor of one of the earlier forms of evolutionary theory, supported the Whigs, and in particular supported I believe her last name was Martineau, who basically championed the destruction of the Elizabethan poor laws, and wrote in support of the basic eugenical regimentation of society at the time. But at any rate, the god of the new priestly caste that we find with the scientific materialist is really an outgrowth of what Charles Darwin called the tree of life. Now, Darwin invoked this metaphor to illustrate the alleged biological connectivity between species. And according to Darwin, this branching divergence could be regressively traced back to common ancestors. But in keeping with his disteleological outlook, Darwin contended that this process of common descent was set into motion by blind, purposeless forces of nature. But this becomes a problem because Darwin's invocation of disteleological mechanisms is basically irreconcilable with the irreducibly teleological character of the evolutionary process itself. No matter how the evolutionist however much the evolutionists might object, the fact remains that the alleged developmental ascent from common ancestors is a system, and systems strive towards a telos, or an end. In the original Greek, it was meant the telos was a purposeful, meaningful end. And this inescapable teleology implies the involvement of some sort of rational agent. And herein you have the premises for a biologicized form of pantheism, where the ancient pantheist posited the spiritual connectivity of all beings within the corpus of an exclusively immanent god. The evolutionist, either implicitly or explicitly, posits the biological connectivity of organisms within a tacitly sentient and self-sufficient natural order. As a matter of fact, Darwin himself once remarked, let me see here. I'll read this quote verbatim for the edification of the audience. Quote, "For brevity's sake, I sometimes speak of natural selection as an intelligent power. I have also often personified the word nature, for I have found it difficult to avoid this ambiguity." Unquote.
Now, it's funny because Darwin urged his readers to ignore the implications of this anthropomorphic language. He basically, he just gave the standard, you know, old school police officer line. Move along, nothing to see here. Yeah, I know I'm referring to nature as she. I know I'm referring to natural selection as a her. I'm saying that that natural selection picks out with unerring skill those members of a species that are meant to survive, thereby implying that there are, you know, actual preferences that this supposed impersonal force, you know, acts upon. But he nevertheless imbued nature with the same powers that pagans ascribe to the various iterations of the Great Mother or the Mother Goddess. And not surprisingly, Charles' grandfather, Erasmus, expressed an overtly pantheistic understanding of nature himself. During a trip to the Blue John Caverns in Derbyshire, England, Erasmus wrote, and this is straight from his journal, by the way, quote, "I have seen the goddess of minerals naked as she lay in her inmost bower," unquote. He also wrote, "I have been into the bowels of old Mother Earth and seen wonders and learnt much curious knowledge in the regions of dark science." Everybody, science, ladies and gentlemen. These are the words of your scientist, which oddly enough sounds to me more like a mystic.
And you have this problem still going on today, because you'll have scientists that talk about natural selection, and they'll talk about the bird that actually had a beak that was long enough to break the shell, to get into the shell, to eat the contents within the shell, and so it was able to beat out the other birds with smaller beaks. And so then you ask the obvious question, well, why does the bird have a beak to begin with? Why does the bird have something that actually betrays purpose, that actually, you know, demonstrates a purpose? And all of a sudden they start to come up with some kind of pantheistic construct to explain how it is that a beak existed in the first place.
Oh, well, actually I had an argument about that with one of the the chief theoreticians of the New Atheist, but an adherent of the New Atheism. He fancied himself quite the intellectual. He said that the reason that there is a teleology implied there is because there exists at this time no vocabulary to effectively enunciate the dysteleological position, which is just the most ridiculous thing to say in the world. First of all, the dysteleological position that all is meaningless and purposeless is self-refuting, because the very proposition presupposes that it is a meaningful proposition. Mm-hmm. How can you posit a meaningless, purposeless universe and present that even as a meaningful and purposeful proposition to begin with? Secondly, that's tantamount to the mystical position that holds that basically describing God is very difficult with our limited vocabulary because he is ineffable. And likewise, it's just difficult to explain this thing, this nebulous thing, this it known as natural selection, because it's ineffable. It just dwarfs and
so you have
dwarfs that outstrips our language. And
you have that desperate preservation of terminological inexactitude once again that we spoke about earlier, that they like, that, you know, allows them to change the rules of polemics whenever, you know, they get caught.
But returning to Erasmus Darwin, arguably his pantheism was not merely a personally held belief. And this is returning to the points that were raised earlier concerning Freemasonry. Arguably, Erasmus's pantheism was pretty much the product of his Masonic heritage. Erasmus became a Mason in the Tyrian Lodge, number 253 at Derby, and it was either in 1807 or 1808. And pantheism and other occult beliefs pervaded the lodge, which was engaged in religious experimentation that would essentially give rise to a syncretistic faith that could unify the disparate factions of the British Empire. And it was this cultural milieu of mystical imperialism that both Erasmus, Darwin, and his grandson, Charles, inhabited.
This would be now, indifferentism and ecumenism, I guess?
Well, it would be with the mystical imperialists, what they were essentially doing was they were trying to develop this syncretistic religion that could unify all of the factions of the empire, draw them together, and give a sense of divine providence to the crusade to spread Pax Britannia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, see, there's no monolithic conspiracy there, but there is a higher degree of coordination than what most people would fancy, and the higher degree of coordination between these the different factions of the elite, which are notorious for entering into internecine competition. One of the ways that they ensure that there's some kind of coordination that keeps some kind of cohesion between those, you know, those different contentious factions is a kind of syncretistic faith that, you know, mixes a little bit of everything into it. Right.
I just find it's interesting because the Rockefellers were very much involved in promoting sort of this mixing of religions. You see that, you know, the church, the chapel in the UN is all New Agey, and even much of what you see in post-consular Catholic churches reflect that too.
Absolutely. And the Rockefellers were also staunch proponents of evolution, mm-hmm, and of evolutionary theory. And the reason being, again, is because you have the paucity of this homogeneity amongst all species. And of course, this, you know, this anthropological proposition that man is one with all the other animals, that there's nothing that really distinguishes him from elevated animality, with the exception of perhaps his intellect. This proposition is transposed by the Rockefellers and other globalists into the realm of socio-political arrangements and becomes globalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by logical, and I think that you can even argue that that this homogeneity, which is already a very extreme form of homogeneity, that they promote has become even more radical since 2013, when the Bilderberg group met, and there seemed to be this kind of embracing among their attendees of transhumanism, because again, globalism promotes this very radical homogeneity. But well, what better way, at least in the eyes of some of the globalists, what better way to promote this radical homogeneity than integrating people into this digital online collective that really replaces personal and private thought with mind melding and groupthink on a level which we have never conceived of before.
Yeah.
But getting thumbs down or something.
Yeah.
How many likes do I have? Yeah.
You should check out my friends list. That means I'm popular, damn it. that the idea that, you know, everybody is downloaded into a computer and becomes part of this kind of online collective consciousness, you can see where some would see it as a biological and technological kind of correlative
to political and economic unification.
That gets back to the hive, right? The
right.
That what was that essay? The bees. Who wrote that again? Was it Weishaupt or?
Yes. Well, Adam Weishaupt referred to the Order of the Illuminati, the subversive organization of the 18th century Enlightenment that played a role in the fomenting of the French Revolution. He referred to it as the Order of the Bees. Mm-hmm. And, of course, bees are a hive organism. That's how their society is structured and how it's arranged. And so it's interesting that you see intimated through Illuminist semiology this collectivism. And the Bavarian Illuminati, among all the syncretistic blends of occult thought that it incorporated into its doctrines, was most prominently pantheism. And as it turns out, there's a body of evidence that Erasmus Darwin may have been a supporter of Weishaupt, and that he actively opposed Robison, who
proofs of a conspiracy.
Yeah, he was a member of the Royal Society and had come across an Illuminist influence in that institution, and so he wrote proofs of a conspiracy to basically expose. Expose the insidious kind of penetration by Illuminists into that institution, into other institutions as well.
Right. Well, and that's really kind of an interesting angle to examine. There is Erasmus's connections with subversive organizations such as the Bavarian Illuminati and the French Revolution. Erasmus Darwin actually expressed explicit sympathy for the ideas of the French Revolution in his literary work entitled The Botanic Garden. And the mother goddess, the earth goddess, was a commonly invoked mythic motif among many French revolutionaries. The same mythic motif is conspicuously present in the frontispiece adorning Erasmus Darwin's major poetic work, The Temple of Nature. And it was rendered by Henry Fuseli. And this frontispiece to Erasmus's poem might actually artistically express the revolutionary objective of toppling Christianity and enshrining a pantheist theocracy. The French Revolution, which was really an outgrowth of the Enlightenment, was awash in mythic signs, in this mythic semiology that had been radically recoded according to an anthropocentric hermeneutic. And so if you situated within the context of revolutionary pantheism and anti-clericism, the naked goddess motif represented man's divinized reason. Nature, which, you know, is that intramundane divinity of which humanity is just but an organismic appendage, yielded up her secrets to the revelatory faculty of reason. And man could achieve apotheosis by wielding this deific power over the material world. And there can be really little wonder why Erasmus supported a revolution of that sort, because his transformationist ideas affirmed the Enlightenment's anthropological assumption that man was really just a tabula rasa whose very ontology could be changed. And Erasmus's son, grandson, Charles, would refine the evolutionary hypothesis and affirm the philosophic radicalism of later socialist revolutionaries. As a matter of fact, I believe it was either Marx or Engels who basically said that whether Darwin accepted it or not, he was a member of the revolution, that of the communist revolution. Now, of course, Charles Darwin himself wouldn't have considered himself a communist, but the point is that the anthropological propositions of evolution, namely the transformationist proposition that humanity is a mutable organism, was very, very amiable to communist propositions, that man could be changed, that man could be altered, even perhaps on the ontological level. But not surprisingly, coercive utopians.
Yeah, it's an invitation to social engineering.
Right, exactly. Because if man is a tabula rasa, if that anthropological assumption holds sway, then all one need do is present all the proper external stimuli and configure society in just the right way so as to make him into the proper collection of behavioral repertoires and make him into the perfect man, the overman. And not surprisingly, this notion of perfectibility, the perfectibility of man, this notion was also one advanced by Adam Weishaupt, whom Erasmus Darwin probably supported. But the I think it's important, though, to realize that in creating a scientific or a pseudo-scientific rationale for the mutability of man, they got the ball rolling on something that they couldn't control. They got a train started that the conductor would lose control of, because I've said it before and I'll say it again because it bears repeating. Revolutionaries are perennially pissed off people. They there's something about adopting a revolutionary identity that turns you into an individual who is perpetually dissatisfied and constantly reconfiguring the world external to you to try to get it to conform to this elusive utopian model.
Well,
both in the French Revolution and here, what in the United States, you have the revolution, the revolutionaries breaking up into two camps, where there's a quote unquote conservative camp that says, hey, look, let's moderate things. Let's put the brakes on it and move a little bit more gradual. We're moving too fast. We'll lose control. And then you have a more radical camp that wants to accelerate things, that wants to speed things up. In France, it was the Girondins and the Jacobins.
Yeah.
And all.
This is the left and right dialectic.
Yeah. Yeah. And here in the here in the United States, I guess that you could say that it's the it's the Yankees, the Northeastern, Atlanticist crowd, and then the Southern Rim, the elites that emerged, during World War II and shortly thereafter, south of that 37th parallel.
Yes, and the Yankee Cowboy War.
Right. And the Yankees and the Cowboys have switched roles, from the time of their Great Schism, which I would place around 1968. Since that time, they've switched roles where one would be the more radical, and then the other would be the more conservative, and then vice versa, and all. So I mean, this whole idea of the mutability of man creates a group of people that are constantly wanting to overturn things, in search of this utopia that just doesn't exist and could never exist. That's the curse of the revolutionary identity. You're going to be perennially pissed off, yep, and you're going to die probably with a frown on your face.
Well, one of the reasons that is if the anthropological proposition of man being inherently mutable holds sway, then it stands to reason that you need only introduce all the proper external stimuli and arrange society in a specific way so as to make of man that perfect being. It's the real problem is not the disordered will of man. No, the real problem for people who adhere to this particular anthropological proposition is the social cosmos. And interestingly enough, this is very close to the same theological error that the Gnostics fell into. The Gnostics believed that corruption and that evil were actually a matter of ontology and not moral orientation, that evil did not originate within the intangible will, but within the tangible world. And so they projected all of the corruption that was within man outside of himself and onto the material world, thus making of it a cesspit, something of a simulacrum that had to be overcome through gnosis. And that's why you see kind of these Gnostic elements to modern revolutionaries. I refer to them as kind of modern docetists, because they are never satisfied with the social cosmos. They're never satisfied with the material world in its present form. They're always seeking to change it, because they believe that from that change will come the necessary change to man.
And they think they're smart enough that they know what changes to make and how to implement them.
Exactly. Right. They're in possession of gnosis.
And if you look at the individuals within this camp that actually retain some kind of Christianity, and they still hold a Christian identity.
Well, a diluted one.
You look at their Christianity and you see of a very identifiable heresy that had been dealt with in the past, based on this idea of, where is evil? Does it reside in the physical universe, or does it reside in our will?
The social gospel and liberation theology, I guess, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. You see very identifiable historical heresies that the church has dealt with in the past.
Yeah, but
it's interesting because you're talking about this idea of this sort of this Gnostic heresy, where you possess the knowledge to how to perfect man.
Right,
and this idea pervades or has origins in this line of thinking, and you have in the 20th century figures like the Rockefellers, who set up University of Chicago, and that's where sociology was mostly developed. And sociology again is a political science or a discipline that was developed for the purposes of social engineering, largely steered by oligarchs like the Rockefellers. Do you see that connection there?
Yes, well, the technocratic origins of sociology are underscored by the very fact that they were founded by none other than Auguste Comte. And, mm-hmm. of course, Auguste Comte was the protege of Henri de Saint-Simon. And Henri de Saint-Simon's ideas were considered the prescription for none other than Sir Francis Bacon's a concept of a new Atlantis, which basically presents this technocratic society where the philosopher kings of Plato's Republic have been supplanted by the scientists and the technical elite. And
do you also see some connections also to perhaps Jewish thought and this idea of tikkun olam and the idea that they can reform the world through political processes?
Absolutely, and it's interesting that you bring that up, because I was coming to that with Erasmus Darwin. We're discussing revolution. Well, revolution is this especially ambitious corporate endeavor, and evolution, the theory of evolution, was a myth that could affirm the revolutionary's docetistic predilections. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you have ceaseless change enjoying pseudoscientific sanctions, and there can be really little wonder why Erasmus Darwin, who supported the radical Jacobins, by the way, worked so hard to popularize the myth of evolution, because his proselytization efforts managed to sway several prominent individuals
as is really evidenced by his indelible impression upon none other than Mary Shelley. And her famous novel, Frankenstein, is premised on the legend of the golem, which is a chimerical creature of Kabbalistic import. And essentially, the golem is this anthropomorphic automaton generated from inanimate matter. And this occult proposition seems to affirm the metaphysical claim of self-creation, which underpins the soteriological claim of self-salvation that one finds inherent to Gnosticism. But in the final analysis, the Darwinian actually tacitly asserts that all organisms, you and I, everything that comprises the biosphere are golems. Categorically, the monster created by the fictional Dr. Frankenstein is just such a being. And not surprisingly, Erasmus Darwin strongly influenced Mary Shelley with his concept of fluid materialism. And just like the fictional character of Dr. Frankenstein, Erasmus believed that lifeless matter could be animated through the introduction of an electrical current. And so the very same, you see that very same proposition underpinning more recent theories like the primordial soup hypothesis.
Yes.
But you see with the golem, this anthropomorphic automaton, you see in that legend, you see kind of this, the anthropological proposition that humanity is something mutable, that humanity is something that can be shaped and created. And also, there's kind of an implicit autotheism to that myth, because if these propositions hold sway, these Kabbalistic propositions hold sway, and the proposition of that man can basically create an anthropomorphic automaton like the golem, and that dead matter is not actually dead, but can be reanimated through electricity, and that this very same process brought all of us into being, you know, electricity, lightning striking this primordial soup, then it stands to reason that man could seize the creative powers that were once reserved exclusively for deities. And this autotheism is actually implied by the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah, or Hebraic school of occultism, represents an inversion of the relationship between creature and creator, and it renders man a divine being who creates and controls God. In fact, the God of Kabbalah, which I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, it's Ein Sof, I think, is actually this impersonal force that can be harnessed and channeled.
It sounds like black magic.
Right, exactly. Or, you know, if you want to invoke a more of a pop culture illusion, it's like the Force from Star Wars. But Hermeticism and Gnosticism provided the sources of Kabbalistic teaching, as was evidenced by the tradition's rather contemptuous view of the corporeal body and the physical world. It regarded this physical world in much the same way that Gnosticism and Hermeticism did. It held it in very, very low regard. But this docetistic cosmological attitude resulted in the assignment of a positive ontological status to evil. Gnostics, Hermeticists, Kabbalists, they all conflated the symptoms of corruption, namely decay, finitude, and death, with the created order. And in essence, they concretized evil and either explicitly or implicitly affirmed this cosmological pessimism. So supposedly, you know, the confining forces of the world had to be overcome. And how do you overcome it? Through the acquisition of gnosis, or, you know, occult secret knowledge. Yep. So these ideas of Kabbalah were eventually co-opted and bolderized by Renaissance-era Italian humanist, who basically transposed gnosis into the immanent sphere. And in so doing, they redefined it as a secret knowledge of how to master the blind forces of nature for a socio-political purpose. And guess what these Italian humanists became? Freemasons.
Yeah, they made their way into the operative guilds, and slowly moved the operative guilds into a more speculative orbit. And really that process which was going on there in the 1600s, was really completed by 1717 with the formation of the First Grand Lodge. And you know, that pretty much saw the shift away from an operative Freemasonry and from a filial Catholic kind of organization to a speculative institution.
I have to imagine the English Reformation played a big part in this because of the crisis of legitimacy with Elizabeth and the idea that obviously the English world had to develop some sort of foundation for its view, and you had people like Sir Isaac Newton who developed idea, you know, his developed the basis for British cosmology, where it's all just physics and there's no teleology to, right, to the universe. It's all gravity and motion and these things, inertia, right. And so that would deprive the universe and therefore ourselves, humanity, of any moral purpose, and therefore. Right. You could rationalize a whole heck of a lot if it's all gravity, inertia. Therefore, whoever has the power determines what's right, and why would the oligarchs want to promote this type of worldview? Well, obviously, if you're an oligarch, you want to do away with ideas of justice and objective right and wrong, objective morality, because in such a world, those who have power determine what's right and wrong.
That's absolutely right, and also the interesting thing about this proposition that it's all really just mechanistic. If there is a God, he's amounts to an absentee landlord, mm-hmm. Deism. But this is every bit as untenable as all of the other nonsense that we've been refuting from the beginning of this interview. Because if you're trying to basically posit these impersonal laws as being the chief causative factors governing the universe, well, that's not going to work, because the problem is that laws are just laws. They're ontologically inert. Okay, they do not create reality. They describe reality. Okay, simply saying 2 + 2 does not give me $4 in my pocket. And so you can see where it becomes just this illusion that they wove over the world of science, over the world of investigation into the natural order.
They've incorporated into finance because of alchemy, and in the world of finance you can just say 2 + 2 = 4, and lo and behold, if you control the printing press or the keyboard, you can create $4.
Yeah, absolutely.
And $4 trillion if you want.
Right. Well, and if you were,
and
like,
then you can insist upon the government paying you back in actual tangibles out of the treasury.
It's survival of the fittest, and we're the top dog, so it's okay.
Right. Exactly. Of course, if you're Alan Greenspan, you're more like Gandalf, because everything he said amounted to nothing more than like an incantation. I mean, it was like riddles.
Frothiness out there. Yeah.
Yes, frothiness. All just empty filler, no meat. But at any rate, so we have with these Italian humanists, we have the origins of the Freemasonic Lodge, of which Erasmus Darwin would become a member. And so that should tell you a little bit something about from which his pantheistic ideas came, was from the lodge, from his Masonic heritage. Also, he was probably influenced heavily by another Freemason by the name of Lord Mombato, who advanced this very unflattering anthropology where the essential ontological differences between humanity and animals were blurred considerably. And as a ma- As a matter of fact, in a poem by, I believe it was Neves, this poem basically asserts that Erasmus Darwin was the undeserving recipient of fame that was actually reserved for Lord Mumbado. But at any rate, Erasmus was also a founder of the Lunar Society, which was an organizational precursor to the Royal Society. And that group was active from roughly, I think, 1764 to about the early 1800s. And it boasted this impressive roster of members, which numbered among its ranks were John Wilkinson, James Watt, Matthew Boulton, Joseph Priestley, Josiah Wedgwood, and, of course, Benjamin Franklin, who was a deist and also had something of a flirtation with socialism. He flirted with some early socialist ideas. But of notable significance is the Lunar Society's decidedly Masonic pedigree. Now, the lodge's spiritual heritage and penchant for political radicalism probably informed the views of not only Erasmus, but some of his fellow Lunar Society members, or as they were called at the time, Lunartics. and the Science and Technology in the Industrial Revolution, the book by A.E. Munson and Eric Robison, it's stated that both the Derby Society and the Lunar Society constituted what they call, in their own words, quote-unquote, a new Freemasonry. And this characterization was strengthened by the Baconian terms invoked by others when referring to Lunar Society members. For instance, Lord Ritchie Calder actually referred to them as Merchants of Light, which is precisely the same appellation assigned to the representatives of Salomon's house in Sir Francis Bacon's New Atlantis. And Nesta Webster, who was cited in J.G. Findle's History of Freemasonry.
Well, she cited that.
She
examined that.
Yeah, she examined the Findle's work. She states that Findle just candidly confessed that the New Atlantis contained unmistakable allusions to Freemasonry, and that Bacon contributed to its final transformation. But Bacon's esoteric patrimony and technocratic ideas, these also formed the corpus of beliefs and ideas in the Lunar Society. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, Adrian Desmond and James Moore in their biography of Darwin refer to the Lunar Society as a circle of technocrats.
The whole Invisible College model from New Atlantis is basically acts as a kind of model for the Royal Society.
Right. And the Lunar Society's prominent influence, it continued on afterwards under the banner of the Royal Society. And in 1864, it was T.H. Huxley, Charles Darwin's bulldog, so to speak. He was a Freemason and a Royal Society member. He and a group of nine men who basically wielded power and influence over almost every famous scientist in the world at the time, as well as a couple of radicals, formed what was known as the X Club. And Desmond and Moore referred to the X Club as a sort of Masonic Darwinian lodge invisible to outsiders. And this was deeply embedded within the bosom of the Royal Society, with the exception of Herbert Spencer. Its members were all secretaries and presidents of learned societies. And Charles Darwin and George Lyell, they weren't members, but their ideas were esteemed very highly by X-Club affiliates. And it was during their dinner meetings that the X-Club actually formulated tactics for controlling the scientific press. As a matter of fact, It was between 1864 and 1884 that the scientific press was quite literally governed by Huxley and his X-Club associates. And you see this with the case of the Bathybius Haeckeli scandal. It was in
the drawings, the fish, and all that.
It was in 1868, and T.H. Huxley was claiming to have discovered these infinitesimal creatures in samples of mud removed from the North Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
They were stored in alcohol, and they were quite obviously dead. But nevertheless, T.H. Huxley believed that the protoplasmic matter was this missing monera in Ernest Haeckel's filial genetic tree. Now, Haeckel had proposed that life originated from primordial slime, but he could produce no transitional forms demonstrated the alleged segue from inorganic matter to organic life.
Yeah, that's something coming from nothing. It just doesn't make any right. sense. Yeah,
exactly. But here comes along Huxley, and he's basically saying, you know, to Haeckel, hey, hold my beer. I've got your back on this. I've discovered the protoplasm that bridges the gap. Well, he was so confident that he dubbed this microscopic species Bathybius Haeckeli in honor of Ernest Haeckel. But in 1875, Huxley's claim was thoroughly refuted by a chemist aboard the HMS Challenger. This chemist observed that the addition of seawater to alcohol created this amorphous precipitate of sulfate lime. And so the chemist discovered that Bathybius was actually gypsum. It was just nothing more than a lifeless Oh, it's like, wow, what a discovery. Life emerged from drywall. but the X Club exerted its considerable influence over the scientific media and almost completely suppressed that revelation. There was maybe an obscure report that did appear in the Quarterly Journal of Microscopical Science. But there was never any public admission of Huxley's error, never. And Haeckel's unrevised and unabridged history of creation, which upheld the view that Bathybius was the primordial slime, remained in circulation until 1923. See, and the funny thing is that these journalistic practices would act as a source not to get too tangential here, but it would act as a source of inspiration for the elite moving forward, because you're basically talking about the Walter Lippmanns of the 19th century here. Mm-hmm. You know, Walter Lippmann would go on to say in public opinion, hey, you know, truth telling and journalism are two different things. Truth and the press are two different things. The press is here to signalize an event. The truth is to get to the substance of the event and to get to the meat and the causative factors and everything. But that's not what the press is about. The press is just there to signalize an event. And so the press chooses to do that any way it sees fit. And he went on to posit a specialized class that would manufacture consent, that would control journalism, that would provide the illusions that were necessary to stave off what he to have a mitigating effect upon what he considered to be the major flaw in democratic experiments, which was the quote unquote omnicompetent man, for him, you know, the idea was that the omnicompetent man only existed on a localized, on a localized level, on the level of the village, where everybody learns everything about the village and gets a turn with you know, with the different functions of the village and all. Well, and on a he held that, well, on a macrocosmic level, that just doesn't apply, you know. And so the only way to do away with to do away with this theory of the omnicompetent man that was a flaw in democratic experiments was to have a special class that controlled the press, that controlled the news, and used the news to manufacture consent as opposed to engage in any kind of truth telling. And here we see all the way back in the 1800s and all, Lippmann's approach to journalism being put into practice long before Walter Lippmann is even thought of.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. With T.H. Huxley, again, you have kind of the antecedent to, you know, all of the media manipulators that would follow, like Ivy Lee and what have you. So Henry Luce and C.D. Jackson. And I gotta say, you know, after you know, I've been working my way through Wim Hof's book over their considerable involvement in the press coverage related to Vatican II, and this recent scandal breaks out with the Time cover, you know, with the little girl standing yes. there crying up at Trump, the President Trump. With no matter what anybody might think of him, yes, he is a member of that semi-submerged oligarchy, but he's kind of a minor oligarch, and he's an outlier who never really made it into the inner sanctum, and he seems to be a member of that ecosystem that realizes that it's time to pull things back in, and that if things aren't pulled back in, then the villagers are going to pull out the pitchforks. But all of he's not the establishment's choice of man in the position of chief executive. You see how they you know did this thing with the recent Time cover mm-hmm. art to attack him, and how blatant the lie was, and how it just came apart and unraveled really quickly. And you're like, oh my God, this the same nonsense that was going on with Luce and Jackson has continued all the way up to the present day with the same publication.
Yeah, well, Time magazine has always been a cesspool of lies, manipulation, propaganda. Same with Life magazine and Fortune, right. And, you know, and even Sports Illustrated. So
the stage was really set when Henry Luce invoked the American century. I mean, everything is now gauged to making sure. Within that particular press organ, everything is gauged at maintaining this American century, which is unsustainable at this juncture.
Yeah, and also it reveals the concentric circles that is the establishment between the intelligence agencies, publishing houses, even Hollywood and these things.
Absolutely. C.D. Jackson was knee-deep in intelligence work before he became the chief go-to guy, basically jack of all trades for Henry Luce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, giving credit where credit's due, these more recent media deceptions and manipulations they've been so clumsily and sloppily carried out. I think, you know, actually these guys could learn a little something from T.H. Huxley. again, he's way back in the 1800s, and his corpse is, you know, just echoing forth from the grave. Here, hold my beer.
Yeah, I don't know how influential Time magazine is anymore.
I don't know how influential CNN is for that matter.
Yeah, so that's part of the reason, because obviously it's supposedly it markets itself as a news magazine, and there it is. It's obviously there's an editorial on the the front cover, you know.
Yeah, with the it's all editorial. It's just nonstop editorializing, even within the body of, you know, an article. But you look at this, this successful effort by the X Club to suppress the embarrassment of the Bathybius Haeckeli scandal, and this perpetuation of the myth all the way to 1923.
Yeah.
So why maintain the illusion? Why sustain the mirage? Well, in essence, and this is what I what I assert in the article. In essence, what you have with these people, in particular, especially the new atheists, are really jihadist. They are really jihadist, waging a holy war on behalf of an intramundane divinity. They are waging a war against the traditional theistic notions of God as espoused by the Abrahamic faiths. They are actually promoting an intramundane deity. And you see, why is that? Well, because with an intramundane divinity, assuming that the god of pantheism holds sway, then it stands to reason that all things constitute the corpus of that deity, that all things are somehow appendages of that divinity, including man himself. And so as an appendage of that intramundane divinity, man, on some ontological level, lays claim to divinity itself. And so you have the cult of reason. As a matter of fact, that the many of the Enlightenment theoreticians referred to the cognitive faculties of man, his cognitive faculties, as being a divinity in and of itself. And there you have the segue from pantheism into autotheism, into the overman. And naturally, if everything evolves, if our biological development is tiered, as Darwin asserted that it was, if it stands to reason that we all occupy different phases in that developmental process, then some are not quite as further along as others. And while some have arrived at the point where they actually have the optimal cognitive faculties, the divinity within has been fully cultivated, then it stands to reason that there are those below them who have not yet truly become what they're supposed to be and may never become what they're supposed to be. And so beings such as that can only hope for one of two things: enslavement or extermination through population control, technological apartheid, eugenics. And you see this with the environmentalists, the radical environmentalist movement. They constantly, you know, invoke the goddess, the mother goddess, the Gaia, what have you. And this mother goddess is being attacked by humanity through environmental degradation, through our use of coal and through our use of oil, and you know, through these practices which were meant to better the human condition, but these practices are actually detrimental to her. So she is merely fighting back. She is exacting reprisal, which, by the way, I find a wee bit ironic, given the fact that many of the atheists object to the actions of God throughout sacred scripture, because whenever God exacts reprisal, whenever God enacts justice, he's viewed as hateful.
His punitive action invites the accusation that he's being capricious,
yeah,
and that he's being arbitrary. But the Earth Mother, for some reason, in her vicious punitive action, is not considered capricious. She's right. Not considered in any way, shape, form, or form to be oppressive or authoritarian in nature or arbitrary. And, you know, so it's the great double standard. Right.
Yeah, and the elite's support of environmentalism or conservationism is always a cynical ploy just to simply use the regulatory process or international treaties to grab control of resources, get right. control of them through under the cover of conservation. Look at the career of, what's his name? You know, up in the Canadian, Rockefeller's boy.
Oh, in Canada, Maurice Strong?
Yeah, Maurice Strong, who tried He's to steal water. Now. Yeah. And ran off to China to avoid prosecution. Yeah. Oil. And same with the Rockefellers, the Grand Tetons, and you hear their stories of how they used the government to buy the land up.
Yeah. Well, Lawrence Rockefeller, who actually lived not too far from where we're at. I mean, well, he lived in Jackson Hole, and all. He was here in Wyoming as well. In Jackson Hole, you really got to have some money to live there. And Lawrence was celebrated in all the major press organs and presented himself as just the consummate environmentalist. But if you look at his involvement and the involvement of his brothers over in the Amazon, and I mean, what is there to brag about here? Yeah. I mean, they were over in Brazil and over in the rainforest, they were really responsible, instrumental in a lot of the deforestation that went on over there.
Well, that's kind of the irony of it too, is you have with the environmentalists, you would think you'd have with them the antithesis of the technocrats, because after all, environmentalists, some of the more extreme factions of environmentalists really qualify as Luddites. And, you know, with technocrats, you have this rampant technophilia. But in actuality, they serve the purposes of technocratically restructuring the world. Because they push for the technological apartheid and for the population control that makes it possible for the world to be technocratically restructured.
Yeah, smart meters, smart technology, right. smart cities, and these things. Yeah,
right.
Agenda 21.
Right. Yeah, Agenda 21. And there's Charles Upton's book, The Vectors of the Counter-Initiation, he actually explores this interesting counterintuitive relationship between the two of them. And what he finds is that the commonality, the dialectical commonality between the technocrats and the environmentalist is the dysteleological proposition that life emerged through the evolutionary process that was guided by blind, purposeless forces. And here it is, one of the reasons why the materialist basically advances the ontological primacy of matter. Matter is all that is there is. The materialist actually contributes to the destruction of the material world. Why? Because they view it through the very unflattering interpretive lens of dysteleology. And also, the materialist is left with the problem of having to account for the mystery of evil. And since the materialist considers the notions of a spiritual reality or a soul as untenable, they ultimately have to trace the origin of evil back to some material cause. And hence, you have campaigns such as the war on drugs, the war on guns, the war on poverty, always something external to the will of humanity. And in this sense, this is a major irony. In this sense, materialists kind of qualify as modern Gnostics. The irony is that the Gnostics reviled matter, believed that matter was illusory, whereas the materialist consider it to be the sole totality of reality. But nevertheless, both assume these docetistic predilections. Both have this very
this very docetistic cosmological pessimism, you know, towards the physical world. And so, of course, with environmentalists who adhere to this syncretistic, kooky blend of New Age spirituality, of which Gnosticism is but one constituent, they end up nevertheless serving the purposes of the technocrats, and they actually contribute to the destruction of the world at the hands of the technocrats. So, you know, wearing your beads and your sandals and chanting your little mantras all you like, you know, at the end of the day, all you're doing is you're aiding the very people that you thought you opposed. But then again, you have dialectical relationships like this down throughout history, you know, super capitalist using communist.
And ideologies themselves are just play things or a form of, I guess, a technology that they use to manipulate, get people to do their bidding for them. And this isn't to say that the oligarchs have complete control, because you're dealing with dynamic individuals, but nevertheless, the broader picture seems to be constantly manipulated in their favor.
Well, ideologies have more of a pragmatic purpose. They're more utilitarian constructs.
This is why the CIA can, we'll work with Nazis, we'll work with Marxists. We'll import cultural Marxists to change American culture. We'll use Nazis for the CIA and NASA, you know, that level, we're all kind of the same anyway.
The Hells Bells, they have no problem, you know, associating with, you know, the KKK or, you know, the more radical strains of environmentalism that push for absolute human annihilation, you know, the human extinction movement, which there's a real rational idea for you, and pushing for the extinction of humanity, which I say, well, Godspeed, you know, how about you first?
Somebody else that should.
Well, a good example of this symbiosis, just look at Ted Kaczynski. Ted Kaczynski, you know, is just the embodiment of radical environmentalism. And yet when he was at Harvard, who did he fall under the sway of? Whose experiment did he participate in? He participated in Henry A. Harry Murray's experiment. And he was basically, you know, everything that you'd expect from one of the Northeastern elite. And he had been with the OSS, the forerunner to the CIA.
Yeah.
At one. So
your mic sounds muffled now. Did you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
That's better. Okay, you were muffled for a couple seconds. Okay.
Yeah, Henry Murray, you know, he was this teacher of social sciences at Harvard. And, you know, here's Ted Kaczynski, the embodiment of radical environmentalism, falls under his sway and becomes a test subject in the Murray experiment. And you find out that, you know, Murray, you know, was heavily influenced by the globalist thinking of Mumford. He had a Northeastern elite kind of pedigree, and he had worked with the Office of Strategic Services, which was the forerunner for the CIA. So you have this relationship between two forces that should be diametrically opposed to one another. You know, Ted Kaczynski should have in no way, form, or fashion been under the sway of somebody like Murray. They supposedly represented two opposing camps, and yet if you really look at it, it's the Murray experiment, and it's kind of the playing with Kaczynski's mind that Henry Murray engaged in that set Kaczynski on his way into this just misanthropic
orbit, this idea that you have to destroy humanity in order to preserve nature.
Yeah, yeah. And there was always some question whether that was some sort of a sub-project of MK Ultra or something.
Well, I mean, it certainly does sound like it. Yeah. when descriptions. I mean, Alston Chase wrote an excellent article about it in the Atlantic Magazine several years, going back several years now. And if you listen to what the experiment entails and just the breaking down of Ted Kaczynski's personality, kind of the tearing down of who he is and the building up of a new persona there, and all, it's certainly, you know, warrants, you know, speculation concerning whether or not this was a subset of the MK Ultra experiments.
Yeah, and it also serves the interest of agencies like, I don't know, like the Federal Bureau of Investigation, perhaps, because having figures that are like that, supposedly randomly mailing bombs out to people, that's a form of strategy of tension, you could say, where the government never owns up to the fact that, you know, that he was a test subject, and perhaps they might have some responsibility in the turn he took, but that's never really covered in the mainstream press. It's just he was supposed to accept the fact that he's a lunatic. But
right.
you know, it's similar to some of the theories that have been posited regarding serial killers, you know, and same with terrorism in general. If you look at things like, you know, the documented cases like Gladio and these things, or how the FBI right now routinely will go out and recruit people to form a terrorist organization so they can, you know, have some crazy crackpot plot to blow up a building somewhere, then they can crack the case and reap the benefits in the press and the budgetary awards, I suppose.
Right.
You know, these things. And, you know, we always talk about, people know about what's going on with police departments, and particularly in Los Angeles, so them supporting some gangs to stir things up a little bit in these communities for whatever reason, to create lucrative drug markets, to justify SWAT teams, or questions regarding the true provenance of the SLA, which is tied back to, I think, you know, that prison out there in Los California, which is tied to MK Ultra. So, you know, all these things, you know, are rather interesting.
Yeah, wasn't it the Vacaville?
Yeah, Vacaville, you know, and the whole Patty Hearst thing, you know, and that whole shootout thing, which was live on television, like a TV show, and all these things. And,
right, you know, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. If I may, Tim, and I don't want to draw it out, you know, too much longer for you, but if I could just make one point though concerning, you know, environmentalism and mm-hmm. and the clearly there are problems with the environmentalist movement, and clearly they are manipulated. Clearly there are money interests that finance them. But I don't want anybody to misunderstand what I'm saying when it comes to environmental concerns. The irony of all this is that pantheist outlook, as it was advanced by the revolutionaries of France, you know, of the Enlightenment, individuals such as those who populated subversive organizations like the Illuminati, all the way to today, with the radical environmentalist movements of today, like Maurice Strong, Al Gore. Okay, all of them are actually seeking to supplant the God, in particular the God of Orthodox Christianity, with their Earth Goddess, with Gaia, with the intramundane divinity that they believe is affirmed by Darwin's theory of evolution. But the fact is that actually it is Orthodox Christianity that is the most world-affirming religion there is, and that it is actually the most environmentally friendly outlook there is. The environmentalist outlook has been consistently afflicted by this antagonistic bifurcation between so-called conservative and liberal attitudes.
Yeah.
Now, the conservative environmentalist is that environmentalism is premised upon a stewardship model, mm-hmm. which really emphasizes humanity's indifferent supremacy over the earth. And meanwhile, liberal environmentalism promotes the earth's stern supremacy over humanity. In fact, liberal environmentalism goes so far as to depict humanity as a parasitic species whose members must be routinely called. As the old bumper sticker goes, save the earth, kill yourself.
Yeah, Paul Ehrlich, right. The population bomb, and why was he promoted? Why is he continually promoted, despite the fact he's been proven wrong, for decades?
Right, where all of his prognostications concerning this, absolute catastrophe by the 1970s just did not come to fruition. Yet, for whatever reason, Al Gore still considered him something of a reliable source. And for some reason, the guy still has speaking engagements. I see him at colleges. With his track record, good grief. He's certainly no Nostradamus, but whatever the case may be, I believe again his prognostications and his lame neo-Malthusian theories are promoted because of the anthropological propositions that they actually affirm, which are promoted by the power elite.
Yeah, but, and this is the reason why he's being booked on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show and Julian right. Simon isn't, right? Who won the bet.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And Julian Simon, by the way, won the bet between him and Ehrlich. Mm-hmm. Ehrlich never did pay him, as I understand it. I could be wrong about that, but I'd be coming to his doorstep, with my wallet open and saying, okay, where's my money? But at any rate, you have situated in the overlooked middle of these two environmentalist attitudes, the conservative and liberal attitudes, you have the orthodox Christian view of environmentalism, which regards the earth as neither humanity's possession or possessor. Instead, both man and earth belong to God. God is the one who owns it all.
So there's still an element of sacredness to it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Rather than being, the world's exploitative proprietor or some alien occupant, we become the priest of the earth. We have to take care of what he's given us because all the world becomes something of a temple. So Orthodox Christianity avoids both the anthropocentric hubris of conservative environmentalism and the anti-human sentiments of liberal environmentalism. Orthodox Christianity elevates the earth, but not to the detriment of man. And all this is also based on a theology where you have a God who is both transcendent, as we made clear at the beginning of this interview. He's not part or ontologically part of the physical universe. Okay, he transcends it, but at the same time he is immanent in that he enters into the world and he fills all things.
Well, I mean that's suggested. Well, the incarnation, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so especially with the incarnation in Orthodox Christianity takes on even broader ramifications. This incarnational theology holds that now you're not just looking at a redemption of man. You're not just looking at the salvation of man. You're looking at a cosmic redemption. And you actually see this in the words of sacred scripture with St. Paul, where he says that all of creation groans for its deliverance, for its redemption. And so this is an extremely world-affirming outlook. This is the most sensible one. This is the one that you would adopt to keep your streams clean, to keep the smoke and the smog out of the air, while at the same time allowing humanity to retain
its intrinsic value, to observe the sanctity of life. You avoid these polar extremes that we see, you know, at work today.
The toxicity, sort of the toxic environment that we're all swimming in today, which produces the long-term health problems like cancer and good example is perhaps the overproduction or the dominance of the petrochemically based products. They had to do that because they had to ban hemp. You know,
right?
How many products could be hemp derived, which present no health problems, but the petrochemically derived, like plastics and polymers, right, and these things. And this isn't to say there wouldn't be some use for plastics, but they wouldn't be so dominant, and nor would we'd be consuming them in what we drink and the food. You know, the same with the there'd be other good example. Perhaps you'd have vegetable-based fuel, which was suppressed in the early part of the 20th century by the Rockefellers.
That's what prohibition was all about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, let's go ahead and place an ethanol, this petroleum additive, that's what the Rockefellers were trying to do with prohibition, was prevent there from being some kind of organic alternative to power cars.
Yeah, and look at agriculture, the concentration of agriculture, big agro industrial farming, how that's it's qualitatively different than localized farming, where the food you get actually has, it's actually isn't fed with chemical fertilizer, so it actually grows with nutrients, and you eat it, and you're healthier, you don't get sick, and that way you don't run off to the medical industrial complex to deal with your long term health problems.
Right. You're no more Frankenfoods.
Yeah.
One individual that pointed this out was Stephen Kunitz, who wrote in October 2000 the October 2000 edition of the American Journal for Public Health. He actually pointed out that wherever the globalist managerial model was applied, wherever took place, that he actually saw a marked deterioration in both the environment and in public health. Mm-hmm. That wherever that model was imposed, that the exact opposite of what was promised in terms of health and environment was what took. The globalist managerial model, it promises improved health and promises a nearly pristine environment, and he actually, wherever that globalist model was imposed, he was able to show there was actually a marked deterioration in the realms of health and in the realms of environment.
Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. Are you asserting that there's a disjunction between a utopian dream and reality? Surely not. I was waiting to see, I was waiting to get my Star Trek, tricorder, and when the Federation was enacted, I mean, when are we going to be beaming? Yeah, it underscores this disjunction between the two. Again, and that's why.
But Stephen Kunist ends up ending that article. Again, and people can look it up, the October 2000 Journal, American Journal of Public Health. He says I'm not fully convinced by globalization. He's like, I'm not convinced that it has the benefits in the fields of health and environment that it has been advertised as possessing, to paraphrase the man.
Yeah, but what else is globalism? What is it? other than, as Father Malachi Martin put it in The Keys of This Blood, he referred to it as, and these are his words, sociopolitical Darwinism.
Hmm.
Why? Yeah, that's what he calls it in that book. And the reason being is because the view, the globalist view, is that the biological interdependence of species that we see, supposedly, you know, with the this biological connectivity between species in the tree of life, which shows that all things came from common ancestors and that all things eventually arose from this one single, you know, this one single organism, you know, one single little, you know, an angry amoeba or what have you. that interdependence, is also translates over to sociopolitical arrangements. And so biological interdependence also must necessarily give way to economic and political interdependence. The globalism can be considered sociopolitical Darwinism. And there you have the reasons for why it was ridiculous, an untenable theory, which, you know, really, you know, was promoted by militant pantheists, occultists, mystical imperialists, Freemasons, revolutionaries. There's ultimately the reason for its promotion. It's meant to signify the crusade to homogenize all of humanity.
Yeah, so these crackpot ideas are picked up by the ultimate pragmatists of the elite, and they implement them because they have the resources, the wherewithal, and the mechanisms to sort of incorporate it everywhere, sort of through their corporations, through their human resources policies, through the media, even certain, just anything, like the TV shows you watch, the types of commercials that are out there, and just what's reported in the news and these things. And this is, yeah, how it's all coordinated. This would be coordinated through maybe the Bilderberg meeting, then through maybe the Council of Foreign Relations, which has journalists, actresses, actors, politicians, industrialists, what have you. And, you know, then have we'll sort of deliver it on a platter, these billionaire. Okay, we got cut off. They're the ultimate pragmatist, and that's why these crazy ideas are picked up by, like technocracy, right? It was picked up years later by Rockefeller and written about by Brzezinski in the late 60s and early 70s, and you have the Trilateral Commission formed to implement the to integrate Asia into this world system. But it also might explain why, you know, we're served up billionaire celebrities, captains of industry like Bill Gates or Elon Musk, to promote things like vaccines or just the worship of technology in these things. And so there's an element of a show to it. And, you know, but you're right. Yeah. So anything else?
Not really.
Okay.
The science is settled. Hey, you're a monkey. Get over it. No, not really. The most recent theoretician who heralds from the new atheist heritage, Richard Dawkins himself, actually synopsized it as follows. He said that he basically characterized pantheism as, in his own words, quote unquote, sexed up atheism.
Hmm.
And that just goes to show, you know, what you thought was, you know, really a fixture of antiquity, what you thought, you know, was supposedly banished by our enlightened modern minds. Yeah, all things are new again.
Hasn't Dawkins lately been trying to rationalize cannibalism as well?
Yeah, cannibalism, so. abortion, a soft form of pedophilia. Soft form of pedophilia. This guy is just, you know, a fount of great ideas. So, yeah,
that should tell you a little something about the type of person you're dealing with and a little something about the outlook that he promotes.
It makes you want to put on your seatbelt every time he gets a light bulb above his head.
Yeah. I mean, I'm waiting for him to come, you know, come on an interview with Bill Maher and say, I believe everybody should own a midget. Why not? You know,
Yeah.
All of the things you won't say, Richard.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. So, okay, well, listen, Paul, Phil, thanks.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Great. And so that's the article is Contingent Divinity. Where's that title here? My computer screen moved a little bit. Contingent Divinity, The Golden Calf of the Universe. That's an excerpt from their forthcoming book, Beyond, Invoking the Beyond. So you can also read their articles at Conspiracy Archive, correct?
That's correct, Tim.
Okay, well, great, Wilson. Thanks. I'll let you go, and I'll post this in a couple of days. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks again for having us on.
Great.
Yeah, thanks, Tim.
Good night, then. Happy 4th.
Yeah, happy 4th.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes was I unwise to leave them open for so long? As I have wandered through this world, and as each moment has unfurled, I've been waiting to awaken from these dreams. People go where they were, I never noticed them until I got this feeling that it's later than it seems. A doctor, my eyes, tell me what you see.